up here with only the buzz of the wasps for company. Fibbin could almost pretend he didn't have a care, in this world or any other. He could put out of his mind wars and all the other silly preoccupations of sapient beings. Fibbin pouted, his expressive lips drooping low. He scratched himself under his arm.
Ook, ook.
He snorted, almost silent laughter, and imagined he was back in an Africa even his great-grandfathers had never seen, in forested hills never touched by his people's two smooth, big-nosed cousins. What would the universe have been like without men, without ETs, without anyone at all but chimps? Sooner or later, we would have invented starships, and the universe might have been ours. The clouds rolled by, and Fibbin lay back on the branch with narrowed eyes, enjoying his fantasy. The wasps buzzed in futile indignation over his presence. He forgave them their insolence as he plucked a few from the air as added morsels. Try as he might, though, he could not maintain the illusion of solitude, for there arrived another sound, an added drone from high above. And try as he might, he couldn't pretend he did not hear alien transports cruising uninvited across the sky. A glistening fence more than 3 meters high undulated over the rolling ground surrounding Port Helena. It was an imposing barrier, put up quickly by special robot machines right after the invasion. There were several gates, through which the city's chim population seemed to come and go without much notice or impediment. But they could not help being intimidated by the sudden new wall. Perhaps that was its basic purpose. How the Gubru would have managed the trick if the capital had been a real city and not just a small town on a rustic colony world. He wondered where the humans were being kept. It was dusk as he passed a wide belt of knee-high tree stumps 100 meters before the alien fence. The area had been planned as a park, but now only splintered fragments lay on the ground all the way to the dark watchtower and open gate. Fibbin steeled himself to go through the same scrutiny as earlier at the checkpoint, but to his surprise no one challenged him. A narrow pool of light spilled onto the highway from a pair of pillar spots. Beyond, he saw dark, angular buildings, the dimly lit streets apparently deserted. The silence was spooky. Fibbin's shoulders hunched as he spoke softly.
"Come on, Tycho, quietly."
The horse blew and pulled the floating wagon slowly past the steel-gray bunker. Fibbin chanced a quick glance inside the structure as he passed. A pair of guards stood within, each perched on one knotted, stick-thin leg, its sharp avian bill buried in the soft down under its left arm. Two saber rifles lay on the counter beside them, near a stack of standard galactic fax boards. Two taloned soldiers appeared to be fast asleep. Fibbin sniffed, his flat nose wrinkling once more at the over-sweet alien aroma. This was not the first time he had seen signs of weakness in the reputedly invincible grip of the Gubru fanatics. They had had it easy until now. Too easy. With the humans nearly all gathered and neutralized, the invaders apparently thought the only possible threat was from space. That, undoubtedly, was why all the fortifications he had seen had faced upward, with little or no provision against attack from the ground. Fibbin stroked his sheathed belt knife. He was tempted to creep into the guard post, slipping under the obvious alarm beams, and teach the Gubru a lesson for their complacency. The urge passed, and he shook his head. "Later," he thought, "when it will hurt them more." Patting Tycho's neck, he led the horse through the lighted area by the guard post, and beyond the gate into the industrial part of town. The streets between the warehouses and factories were quiet, a few chims here and there hurrying about on errands beneath the scrutiny of the occasional passing Goobru patrol skimmer. Taking pains not to be observed, Fibbins slipped into a side alley and found a windowless storage building not far from the colony's sole iron foundry. Under his whispered urging, Tycho pulled the floating hover over to the shadows by the back door of the warehouse. A layer of dust showed that the padlock had not been touched in weeks. He examined it closely. Fibbin took a rag from his belt apron and wrapped it around the hasp. Taking it firmly in both hands, he closed his eyes and counted to three before yanking down hard. The lock was strong, but, as he'd suspected, the ring bolt in the door was corroded. It snapped with a muffled crack. Quickly, Fibbin slipped the sheaf and pushed the door along its tracks. Tycho placidly followed him into the gloomy interior, the truck trailing behind. Fibbin looked around to memorize the layout of hulking presses and metalworking machinery before hurrying back to close the door again.
"You'll be all right," he said softly as he unhitched the animal. He hauled a sack of oats out of the hover and split it open on the ground. Then he filled a tub with water from a nearby tap. "I'll be back if I can," he added. "If not, you just enjoy the oats for a couple of days, then whinny. I'm sure someone will be by."
Tycho switched his tail and looked up from the grain. He gave Fibbin a baleful look in the dim light and let out another smelly, gassy commentary.
"Humph," Fibbin nodded, waving away the smell. "You're probably right, old friend. Still, I'll wager your descendants will worry too much, too, if and when somebody ever gives them the dubious gift of so-called intelligence."
He patted the horse in farewell and loped over to the door to peer outside. It looked clear out there, quieter than even the gene-poor forests of Garth. The navigation beacon atop the Terrigan's building still flashed, no doubt used now to guide the invaders in their night operations. Somewhere in the distance, a faint electric hum could be heard. It wasn't far from here to the place where he was supposed to meet his contact. This would be the riskiest part of his foray into town. Many frantic ideas had been proposed during the 2 days between the initial Goobru gas attacks and the invaders' complete seizure of all forms of communication. Hurried, frenzied telephone calls and radio messages had surged from Port Helena to the archipelago and to the continental outlands. During that time, the human population had been thoroughly distracted, and what remained of government communications were coded. So it was mainly chims, acting privately, who filled the airwaves with panicked conjectures and wild schemes, most of them horrifically dumb. Fibbin figured that was just as well, for no doubt the enemy had been listening in even then. Their opinion of neo-chimps must have been reinforced by the hysteria. Still, here and there had been voices that sounded rational.
"Wheat hidden amid the chaff."
Before she died, the human anthropologist, Dr. Taka, had identified one message as having come from one of her former postdoctoral students, one Galet Jones, a resident of Port Helena. It was this chim the general had decided to send Fibbin to contact. Unfortunately, there had been so much confusion. No one but Dr. Taka could say what this Jones person looked like. And by the time someone thought to ask her, Dr. Taka was dead. Fibbin's confidence in the rendezvous site and password was slim at best.
"Probably we haven't even got the night right," he grumbled to himself.
He slipped outside and closed the door again, replacing the shattered bolt so the lock hung back in place. The ring tilted at a slight angle.
but it could fool someone who wasn't looking very carefully. The larger moon would be up in an hour or so. He had to move if he was going to make his appointment in time. Closer to the center of Port Helena, but still on the wrong side of town, he stopped in a small plaza to watch light pour from the narrow basement window of a working Chim's bar. Bass-heavy music caused the panes to shake in their wooden frames. Fibbin could feel the vibration all the way across the street, through the soles of his feet. It was the only sign of life for blocks in all directions, if one did not count quiet apartments, where dim lights shone dimly through tightly drawn curtains. He faded back into the shadows as a whirring patroller robot cruised by, floating a meter above the roadway. The squat machine's turret swiveled to fix on his position as it passed. Its sensors must have picked him out, an infrared glow in the misty trees. But the machine went on, probably having identified him as a mere neo-chimpanzee. Fibbin had seen other dark-furred forms like himself, hurrying, hunch-shouldered through the streets. Apparently the curfew was more psychological than martial. The occupation forces weren't being strict, because there didn't seem to be any need. Many of those not in their homes had been heading for places like this, the Ape's Grape. Fibbin forced himself to stop scratching a persistent itch under his chin. This was the sort of establishment favored by grunt laborers and probationers, Chims whose reproductive privileges were restricted by the Edicts of Uplift. There were laws requiring even humans to seek genetic counseling when they bred. But for their clients, neo-dolphins and neo-chimpanzees, the codes were far more severe. In this one area, normally liberal Terran law adhered closely to galactic standards. It was that, or lose Chims and Finns forever to some more senior clan. Earth was far too weak to defy the most honored of galactic traditions. About a third of the Chim population carried green reproduction cards, allowing them to control their own fertility, subject only to guidance from the Uplift Board, and possible penalties if they weren't careful. Those Chims with gray or yellow cards were more restricted. They could apply after they joined a marriage group, to reclaim and use the sperm or ova they stored with the board during adolescence, before routine sterilization. Permission might be granted if they achieved meritorious accomplishments in life. More often, a yellow card chimmy would carry to term and adopt an embryo engineered with the next generation of improvements inserted by the board's technicians. Those with red cards weren't even allowed near Chim children. By pre-contact standards, the system might have sounded cruel, but Fibbin had lived with it all his life. On the fast track of Uplift, a client race's gene pool was always being meddled with. At least Chims were consulted as part of the process. Not many client species were so lucky. The social upshot, though, was that there were classes among Chims, and blue carders, like Fibbin, weren't exactly welcome in places like the Ape's Grape. Still, this was the site chosen by his contact. There had been no further messages, so he had no choice but to see if the rendezvous would be kept. Taking a deep breath, he stepped into the street and walked toward the growling, crashing music. As his hand touched the door handle, a voice whispered from the shadows to his left. "Pink?" At first he thought he had imagined it, but the words repeated a little louder. "Pink? Looking for a party?" Fibbin stared. The light from the window had spoiled his night vision, but he caught a glimpse of a small simian face, somewhat childlike. There was a flash of white as the Chim smiled. "Pink party?" He let go of the handle, hardly able to believe his ears. I beg your pardon?
Pippin took a step forward, but at that moment the door opened, spilling light and noise out into the street. Several dark shapes, hooting with laughter and stinking of beer-soaked fur, pushed him aside as they stumbled past. By the time the revelers were gone and the door had closed again, the blurry dark alley was empty once more. The small, shadowy figure had slipped away. Pippin felt tempted to follow, if only to verify that he had been offered what he thought he had. And why was the proposition, once tendered, so suddenly withdrawn? Obviously things had changed in Port Helena. True, he hadn't been to a place like the Ape's Grape since his college days, but pimps pandering out of dark alleys were not common even in this part of town. On Earth, maybe, or in old 3V films, but here on Garth? He shook his head in mystification and pulled open the door to go inside. Pippin's nostrils flared at the thick aromas of beer and sniff-high and wet fur. The descent into the club was made unnerving by the sharp, sudden glare of a strobe light, flashing starkly and intermittently over the dance floor. There several dark shapes cavorted, waving what looked like small saplings over their heads. A heavy, soul-penetrating beat pounded from amplifiers set over a group of squatting musicians. Customers lay on reed mats and cushions, smoking, drinking from paper bottles, and muttering coarse observations on the dancers' performances. Pippin wended his way between the close-packed, low wicker tables toward the smoke-shrouded bar, where he ordered a pint of bitters. Fortunately, colonial currency still seemed to be good. He lounged against the rail and began a slow scan of the clientele, wishing the message from their contact had been less vague. Pippin was looking for someone dressed as a fisherman, even though this place was halfway across town from the docks on Aspinall Bay. Of course, the radio operator who had taken down the message from Dr. Taka's former student might have gotten it all wrong on that awful evening, while the Howlett Center burned and ambulances whined overhead. The Chen had thought he recalled Galet Jones saying something about a fisherman with a bad complexion. Great, Pippin had muttered when given his instructions. Real spy stuff. Magnificent. Deep down, he was positive the clerk had simply copied the entire thing down wrong. It wasn't exactly an auspicious way to start an insurrection. But that was no surprise, really, except to a few chims who had undergone Terrigan's service training. Secret codes, disguises, and passwords were the contents of old-time thrillers. Presumably, those militia officers were all dead or intern now. Except for me. And my specialty wasn't intelligence or subterfuge. Hell, I could barely jockey poor old TAASF proconsul. The resistance would have to learn as it went now, stumbling in the dark. At least the beer tasted good, especially after that long trek on the dusty road. Pippin sipped from his paper bottle and tried to relax. He nodded with the thunder music and grinned at the antics of the dancers. They were all males, of course, out there capering under the flashing strobes. Among the grunts and probationers, feeling about this was so strong that it might even be called religious. The humans, who tended to frown over most types of sexual discrimination, did not interfere in this case. Client races had the right to develop their own traditions, so long as they didn't interfere with their duties or uplift. And according to this generation at least, chimmies had no place in the thunder dance, and that was that. Pippin watched one big naked male leap to the top of a jumbled pile of carpeted rocks, brandishing a shaker twig. The dancer, by day perhaps a mechanic or a factory laborer, waved the noisemaker over his head while drums pealed and strobes lanced artificial lightning overhead, turning him momentarily
half stark white and half pitch black. The shaker twig rattled and boomed as he huffed and hopped to the music, hooting as if to defy the gods of the sky. Bibbon had often wondered how much of the popularity of the thunder dance came from innate, inherited feelings of brontophilia, and how much from the well-known fact that fallow, unmodified chimps in the jungles of Earth were observed to dance, in some crude fashion, during lightning storms. He suspected that a lot of neo-chimpanzee tradition came from elaborating on the publicized behavior of their unmodified cousins. Like many college-trained chims, Bibbon liked to think he was too sophisticated for such simple-minded ancestor worship, and generally he did prefer Bach or whale songs to simulated thunder. And yet, there were times, alone in his apartment, when he would pull a tape by the fulminates out of a drawer, put on the headphones, and try to see how much pounding his skull could take without splitting open. Here, under the driving amplifiers, he couldn't help feeling a thrill run up his spine, as lightning bolted across the room, and the beating drums rocked patrons, furniture, and fixtures alike. Another naked dancer climbed the mound, shaking his own branch and chuffing loudly in challenge. He crouched on one knuckle as he ascended, a stylish touch frowned upon by orthopedists, but meeting with approval from the cheering audience. The fellow might pay for the verisimilitude with a morning backache, but what was that next to the glory of the dance? The ape at the top of the hill hooted at his challenger. He leapt and whirled in a finely timed maneuver, shaking his branch just as another bolt of strobe lightning whitened the room. It was a savage and powerful image, a reminder that no more than four centuries ago his wild ancestors had challenged storms in a like fashion from forest hilltops, needing neither man nor his tootling scalpels to tell them that heaven's fury required a reply. The chims at the table shouted and applauded as the king of the hill jumped from the summit, grinning. He tumbled down the mound, giving his challenger a solid whack as he passed. This was another reason females seldom joined the thunder dance. A full-grown male neo-chim had most of the strength of his natural cousins on Earth. Chimmies who wanted to participate generally played in the band. Bibbon had always found it curious that it was so different among humans. Their males seemed more often obsessed with the sound making and the females with dance, rather than vice versa. Of course, humans were strange in other ways as well, such as in their odd sexual practices. He scanned the club. Males usually outnumbered females in bars like this one, but tonight the number of chimmies seemed particularly small. They mostly sat in large groups of friends, with big males at the periphery. Of course, there were the barmaids, circulating among the low tables, carrying drinks and smokes, dressed in simulated leopard skins. Bibbon was beginning to worry. How was his contact to know him in this blaring, flashing madhouse? He didn't see anyone who looked like a scar-faced fisherman. A balcony lined the three walls facing the dance mound. Patrons leaned over, banging on the slats and encouraging the dancers. Bibbon turned and backed up to get a better look, and almost stumbled over a low wicker table as he blinked in amazement. There, in an area set aside by rope barrier, guarded by four floating battle robots, sat one of the invaders. There was the narrow white mass of feathers, the sharp breastbone, and that curved beak. But this Gubru wore what looked like a woolen cap over the top of its head, where its comb-like hearing organ lay. A set of dark goggles covered its eyes. Bibbon made himself look away. It wouldn't do to seem too surprised. Apparently the customers here had had the last few weeks to get used to an alien in their midst. Now, though, Fibbon did notice occasional glances nervously cast up toward the box above the bar. Perhaps the added tension helped explain the frantic mood of the revelers, for the grape seemed unusually rowdy, even for a working Chim's bar. Sipping his pint bottle casually, Fibbon glanced up again. The Goobru doubtless wore the cap-like muff and goggles as protection from the noise and lights. The guard bots had only sealed off a square area near the alien, but that entire wing of the balcony was almost unpopulated. Almost. Two Chims, in fact, sat within the protected area, near the sharp-beaked Goobru. Quislings? Fibbon wondered. Are there traitors among us already? He shook his head in mystification. Why was the Goobru here? What could one of the invaders possibly find of worth to notice? Fibbon reclaimed his place at the bar. Obviously, they're interested in Chims, and for reasons other than our value as hostages. But what were those reasons? Why should Galactics care about a bunch of hairy clients that some hardly credited with being intelligent at all? The Thunder Dance climaxed in an abrupt crescendo and one final crash, its last rumblings diminishing as if into a cloudy, stormy distance. The echoes took seconds longer to die away inside Fibbon's head. Dancers tumbled back to their tables, grinning and sweating, wrapping loose robes around their nakedness. The laughter sounded hearty, perhaps too much so. Now that Fibbon understood the tension in this place, he wondered why anyone came at all. Boycotting an establishment patronized by the invader would seem such a simple, obvious form of ahisma, of passive resistance. Surely the average Chim on the street resented these enemies of all Terrigans. What drew such crowds here on a weeknight? Fibbon ordered another beer for appearances, though already he was thinking about leaving. The Goobru made him nervous. If his contact wasn't going to show, he had better get out of here and begin his own investigations. Somehow he had to find out what was going on here in Port Helena, and discover a way to make contact with those willing to organize. Across the room, a crowd of recumbent revelers began pounding the floor and chanting. Soon, the shout spread through the hall. Sylvie! Sylvie! The musicians climbed back onto their platform, and the audience applauded as they started up again, this time to a much gentler beat. A pair of chimneys crooned seductively on saxophones as the house lights dimmed. A spotlight speared down to illuminate the pinnacle of the dancer's mound, and a new figure swept out of a beaded curtain to stand under the dazzling beam. Fibbon blinked in surprise. What was a chimney doing up there? The upper half of her face was covered by a beaked mask, crested with white feathers. The femme chim's bare nipples were flecked with sparkles to stand out in the light. Her skirt of silvery strips began to sway with a slow rhythm. The pelvises of female neo-chimpanzees were wider than their ancestors, in order to pass bigger-brained progeny. Nevertheless, swinging hips had never become an ingrained erotic stimulus, a male turn-on, as it was among humans. And yet, Fibbon's heart beat faster as he watched her alliciant movements. In spite of the mask, his first impression had been of a young girl, but soon he realized that the dancer was a mature female, with faint marks of having nursed. It made her look all the more alluring. As she moved, the swaying strips of her skirt flapped slightly, and Fibbon soon saw that the fabric was silvery only on the outside. On the inner face, each stripe of fabric tinted gradually upward toward a bright rosy color. He flushed and turned away. The Thunder Dance was one thing. He had participated in a few himself, but this was altogether different. First the little panderer in the alley, and now this? Had the Chims of Port Helena gone sex-crazed? An abrupt, meaty pressure came down upon his shoulder. Fibbon looked up to see a large, fur-backed hand resting there, leading up a hairy arm to one of the biggest Chims he had ever seen. He was nearly as tall as a small man, and obviously much stronger. The male Neo-Chimp wore faded blue work dungarees, and his upper lip curled back to expose substantial, almost atavistic canines.
"Smatter, you don't like Sylvie?" the giant asked.
Although the dance was still in its languid opening phase, the mostly male audience was already hooting encouragement. Fibbon realized he must have been wearing his disapproval on his face like an idiot. A true spy would have feigned enjoyment in order to fit in.
"Headache," he pointed to his right temple. "Rough day. I guess I'd better go."
The big Neo-Chimp grinned, his huge paw not leaving Fibbon's shoulder.
"Headache? Or maybe it's too bold for you. Maybe you ain't had your first sharing yet, hm?"
Out of the corner of his eye, Fibbon saw a swaying, teasing display, still demure, but growing more sensual by the moment. He could feel the seething sexual tension beginning to fill the room, and couldn't guess where it might lead. There were important reasons why this sort of display was illegal, one of the few activities humans proscribe their clients.
"Of course I've been in sharings," he snapped back. "It's just that here, in public, it could cause a riot."
The big stranger laughed and poked him amiably.
"When?"
"I beg your pardon? What do you mean?"
"I mean, when did you first share, hm? From the way you talk, I'll bet it was one of those college parties, right? Am I right, Mr. Blue Card?"
Fibbon glanced quickly right and left. First impressions notwithstanding, the big fellow seemed more curious and drunk than hostile. But Fibbon wished he'd go away. His size was intimidating, and they might be attracting attention.
"Yeah," he muttered, uncomfortable with the recollection. "It was a fraternity initiation."
The Chimmy students back at college might be good friends with the Chens in their classes, but they were never invited to sharings. It was just too dangerous to think of green card females sexually. And anyway, they tended to be paranoid about pregnancy before marriage and genetic counseling. The possible costs were just too great. So when Chens at the university threw a party, they tended to invite girl Chims from the far side of the tracks, yellow and gray card Chimmies, whose flame-colored estrus was only an exciting sham. It was a mistake to judge such behavior by human standards.
"We have fundamentally different patterns,"
Fibbon had reminded himself back then, and many times since. Still, he had never found those sharings very satisfying or joyful. Maybe someday when he found the right marriage group.
"Sure, my sis used to go to those college parties. Sounded like fun."
The scarred Chim turned to the bartender and slapped the polished surface.
2 pints, one for me and one for my college chum."
Fibbon winced at the loud voice. Several others nearby had turned to look their way.
"So tell me,"
his unwelcome acquaintance said, thrusting a paper bottle into Fibbon's hand.
"You have any kids yet? Maybe some that are registered, but you never met?"
He did not sound unfriendly, rather envious. Fibbon took a long swallow of the warm, bitter brew. He shook his head, keeping his voice low.
It doesn't really work that way. An open birthright isn't the same as an unlimited, a white card. If the planners have used any of my plasm, I wouldn't know it.
Well, why the hell not? I mean, it's bad enough for you bluesies having to screw test tubes on orders from the uplift board, but to not even know if they've used the gunk. Hell, my senior group wife had a planned kid a year ago. You might even be my son's gene dad.
The big Jim laughed and clapped Fibbon again heavily on the shoulder. This would never do. More heads were turning his way. All this talk about blue cards was not going to win him friends here. Anyway, he did not want to attract attention with the Goobru sitting less than 30 feet away.
I really have to be going, he said, and started to edge backward. Thanks for the beer.
Somebody blocked his way.
Excuse me, Fibbon said.
He turned and came face to face with 4 chims clothed in bright zip suits, all staring at him with arms crossed. One, a little taller than the others, pushed Fibbon back toward the bar.
Of course, this one's got offspring, the newcomer growled.
He had trimmed his facial hair, and the remaining mustache was waxed and pointed.
Just look at those paws of his. I'll bet he's never done a day of honest chim's work. Probably he's a tech or a scientist.
He made it sound as if the very idea of a neo-chimp wearing such a title was like a privileged child being allowed to play a complicated game of pretend. The irony of it was that while Fibbon's hands might be less calloused than many here, under his shirt were burn scars from crash landing on a hillside at Mach 5. But it wouldn't do to speak of that here.
Look, fellas, why don't I buy a round?
His money flew across the bar as the tallest zip-suiter slapped his hand.
Worthless crap! They'll be collecting it soon like they'll be collecting you ape aristocrats.
Shut up!
Somebody yelled from the crowd, a brown mass of hunched shoulders. Fibbon glimpsed Sylvie, rocking up on the mound. The separate strips of her skirt rippled, and Fibbon caught a glimpse that made him start with amazement. She really was pink, her briefly exposed genitals in full estrus. The zip-suiter prodded Fibbon again.
Well, Mr. College Man, what good is your blue card gonna do you when the Goobros start collecting and sterilizing all you free breeders, huh?
One of the newcomers, a slope-shouldered chim with a barbelet, receding forehead, had a hand in a pocket of his bright garment, gripping a pointed object. His sharp eyes seemed carnivorously intent, and he left the talking to his mustachioed friend. Fibbon had just come to realize that these guys had nothing to do with the big chim in the dungarees. In fact, that fellow had already edged away into the shadows.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You don't. They've been going through the colonial records, bub, and picking up a lot of college chims like you for questioning. So far, they've just been taking samples, but I've got friends who say they're planning a full-tilt purge. Now, what do you think of that?
Shut the fuck up!
Someone yelled. This time, several faces turned. Fibbon saw glazed eyes, flecks of saliva, and bared fangs. He felt torn. He wanted desperately to get out of here. But what if there were some truth in what the zip-suits were saying? If so, this was important information. Fibbon decided to listen a little while longer.
That's pretty surprising, he said, putting an elbow on the bar. The Goobru are fanatical conservatives.
Whatever they do to other patron-level races, I'd bet they'd never interfere with the process of uplift. It's against their own religion. Mustache only smiled. Is that what your college education tells you, Blue Boy? Well, it's what the Galactics are saying that counts now. They were crowding Fibbon, this bunch who seemed more interested in him than in Sylvie's provocative gyrations. The crowd was hooting louder, the music beating harder. Fibbon's head felt as if it might crack under the noise. Too cool to enjoy a working man's show? Never done any real labor, but snap his fingers, and our own chimneys come running. Fibbon could tell something was false here. The one with the mustache was overly calm, his barratrous taunts too deliberate. In an environment like this, with all the noise and sexual tension, a true grunt shouldn't be able to focus so well.
Probationers, he realized suddenly.
Now he saw the signs. Two of the zip-suited Chim's faces bore the stigmata of failed genetic meddling, mottled cacophrenic features, or the blinking, forever puzzled look of a cross-wired brain, embarrassing reminders that uplift was an awkward process, not without its price. He had read in a local magazine, not long before the invasion, how the trendy crowd in the Proby community had taken to wearing garishly colored zip suits. Fibbon knew suddenly that he had attracted the very worst kind of attention. Without humans around or any sign of normal civil authority, there was no telling what these red cards were up to. Obviously, he had to get out of here. But how? The zip suits were crowding him closer every moment.
Look, fellas, I just came here to see what's happening. Thanks for your opinion. Now, I really gotta go.
I got a better idea, the leader sneered. How about we introduce you to a Goobru who'll tell you for himself what's going on and what they're planning to do with college Chims, huh?
Fibbon blinked. Could these Chens actually be cooperating with the invader? He had studied old Earth history, the long dark centuries before contact, when lonely and ignorant humanity had experimented horribly in everything from mysticism to tyranny and war. He had seen and read countless portrayals of those ancient times, especially tales of solitary men and women who had taken brave, often hopeless stands against evil. Fibbon had joined the colonial militia partly in a romantic wish to emulate the brave fighters of the Maquis, the Palmach, and the Power Satellite League. But history told of traitors also, those who sought advantage wherever it could be found, even over the backs of their comrades.
Come on, college chum, there's a bird I want you to meet.